Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. In the chanting that we did at the beginning of the evening, this is spelling out the relationship, the connections between anicca, dukkha, anatta, unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and not self, with the you can leave off, okay, with the five khandhas, or the five groups, as we've been talking about a lot in the last few days. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, these are familiar phrases to us, and then the analysis of the body and mind into these five groups. This is a way that the Buddha used to sort of conveniently slicing the pie of body and mind. So you have the rupa section, the body, and then the nama section, the mind section of feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. Oh, you can, you know, make it even simpler as just having, you know, two parts, nama and rupa, body and mind. We often associate the development of insight, and we've been talking about this a lot in the meditation instruction, as developed around these insights into anicca, dukkha, anatta. So these are usually known as the three characteristics of existence, meaning that these are the three qualities that all things possess, whether those things are material, as in the, you know, the body or the world around us, this room, these buildings. You know, the material form is changing, it's unsatisfactory, it can't be permanently pleasing, and it's not self, it's not me or mine, it's not something that is, personal in any absolute way. The quality of unsatisfactoriness, quality of not-self, these can be said also to be characteristics of all of the mental world as well, whether it's a feeling, whether it's a perception, what we hear or see or smell or taste or touch, or mental formation, an emotion, a memory, an idea. So this is familiar territory for most of us. This is an experienced group, as Stephen has been pointing out to me. So this is well-trodden territory. Oh, the three characteristics, as we know them, anicca, dukkha, anatta, are not the only characteristics that all things possess. And one of the great spiritual teachers of current times in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa, during the latter years of his life, he talked about other characteristics of existence to reflect upon. And so as I was talking about atamayata the other night, this is one of the qualities that he pointed to as being a characteristic of all existent things. And he created a group a more subtle and profound set of three qualities that are the also characteristics of all existent things. So sunyata, emptiness, that all things are empty, all aspects of material form, the physical world, all aspects of the mental world are all sunyata, they're sunya, they're empty. So emptiness, insubstantiality is the characteristic of all things. And then the second of this group of three is tatata, or suchness. The other day I was talking about tat as in the word Tathagata that the Buddha coined. So tat means such or thus. So tatata means suchness or thusness. So these are ways of say, looking at all things. All things, material and physical and mental, are empty. They are also thus or such. There's a quality of suchness to them. So in a way, emptiness is a way of saying no to everything, and suchness is a way of saying yes to everything. And then the third of the group is atamayata. And again, Ajahn Buddhadasa pointed out that atamayata, as he phrased it, is the ultimate Buddhist concept. It's sort of the last concept before concepts run out. It's like, that's the last money you change before you go through the border. It's like, that's the last exchangeable concept before concepts fall away. And atamayata is in a way saying, as you say, emptiness is saying no to everything. Tatata is saying yes to everything. Atamayata is saying there isn't any everything. there is no that. So the emptiness is saying that is empty. Tatata is saying that is such or thus. And Atamayata is saying there isn't really any that. So this is another set of principles that we can use to explore our experience, rather than just using anicca, dukkha, anatta as the only framework. We can also use these three qualities of sunyata, tatata, and atamayata as a way of exploring the feelings, perceptions, thoughts, and the material realm inside and outside. One of the themes that I've been bringing up and is related again to these qualities is how we often assume that peace comes from when we're not being quote unquote bothered by things. That if only this pain would go away, then I would be happy. If only I didn't have this job I had to go to, then I'd be happy. If only that noise would stop, I'd be happy. It's the sort of, it doesn't really work in Israel, but in the rest of the world where they have the the 7-day week and the weekend of Saturday and Sunday, it's called the thank God it's Friday principle. You know, thank God it's Friday, here comes the weekend, hooray! Looking forward to retirement, looking forward to the holiday, looking forward to the bell at the end of the sitting, when everything's going to be fine. You know, over there, When this irritating thing has gone, then I will be happy. Today I was talking with someone, and he was saying how difficult his practice was. Didn't seem to be going anywhere, no matter, you know, whether he did sitting or walking or standing, every kind of meditation. His mind was just really, really active, and the practice didn't seem to make much of an impression upon it. And then we were talking a little bit more, and I asked him what his occupation was, and he said, "Well, I'm a news editor." I said, "Well, if you're a news editor, it's kind of goes with the job that you got a lot of information to process. You got a lot of thinking to do, and if you're doing that every day, then of course, at the end of the day, there's going to be a lot of stuff coming through the system." And I was also reminded many years ago when Ajahn Sumedho first came to England, and almost identical conversation happened between him and a woman who came to the Hampstead Vihara. This is back in the 70s. And she said almost exactly the same as the fellow was saying to me today. He said, "Oh, you know, I try so hard. I'm very sincere in my practice. I, you know, keep working at it. But, you know, my mind is just going on and on and on. You know, my thoughts never really seem to slow down." And then again, he asked her, well, what kind of job do you do? And in those days, there used to be a thing called a telephone exchange. Have you seen it in the movies? But somebody would sit in a little office and they had a whole massive wall in front of them with lots of sockets, lots of holes, and then cables that they would connect a phone call. Person A would ring in and they'd say, you know, please connect me to this number. And you'd take a cable and then stick the cable into the right socket. And the person who did that was called a telephonist. This is long before the era of cell phones and automated connections. So she was a telephonist. So all day long, she was sitting in this little cubicle with bells going and having to connect the, you know, the right plugs into the right sockets and then disconnect them and reconnect. And he said, well, it's hardly a surprise that your mind is very busy at the end of the day if you're sitting in the, in that cubicle, and having to do that kind of rapid processing of information. So, I thought this was an interesting, useful conversation that we had earlier on, because natural enough for us to think, oh, if only my thoughts would stop, then I would be peaceful, then my practice would really be going somewhere. Well, that would be a good sign that I'm progressing. But if the world that we're in is naturally creating a lot of noise, then that silence that is not going to be there. The world that we're in is generating a lot of information and a lot of decision-making that we have to do, then that's going to have its ripples. Again, earlier today we were talking about karma and its results, karma vipaka. If you work in a telephone exchange, yeah, a lot of bells, a lot of choices to make. That is going to have that effect. So, what I was emphasizing then, and I thought to bring up this evening, is how peace is not, at least peace as we mean it in Buddhist psychology, is not a matter of waiting for all the world to stop. It's not a matter of the weekend, the retirement, or even, you know, the bell at the end of the sitting. You know, notice how peaceful the mind gets. But the peace that's coming at the end of the sitting when the bell rings is suddenly I don't have to be doing something. Yeah, it's part of it. So rather, peace is in the attitude that we have to the thing rather than trying to stop all the things, I would suggest. So that these reflections on emptiness, the emptiness of things, the suchness of things, or the non-thingness of things, if I can coin that word. So I just invented that this minute. Just in case you want to try to find the Pali for that, you won't, because I just made it up. You know. So, Ajahn Chah also put it, you know, peace, and the way we are as human beings, said, When you're with your friends, you get irritated with your friends. When you're alone, you get lonely. Peace doesn't come from either being by yourself or being with your friends. Peace comes from right understanding. So he was a real master of the kind of Dharmic one-liner. Even though they were in Thai, he was really very, very, very gifted at these little snapshots of reality. So it's not a matter of being alone or being with others, but right understanding. So that the way that we receive the world that makes a difference, rather than trying to stop the world. So there's a couple of teachings again from the suttas that I thought might be useful to share, and these might be very well known to you. They're sort of standard features of very well-known teachings, but it's also useful to explore. So the first one is called the Kevada Sutta. It's in the Digha Nikaya, the Long Discourses. And the Buddha tells a story in this sutta to illustrate this point. And he says, once upon a time, there was a particular monk who was meditating. He was quite a gifted meditator. In the mind of this monk, there arose the thought, where is it that nama and rupa, body and mind, or name and form, where is it that nama and rupa fade out and cease without remainder? Like, you know, where does all this stuff come to an end? So the he doesn't spell it out in detail, but I would suggest it's the same kind of area, like sitting there meditating and something feeling, I wish if this all just stopped, all this stuff came to an end, then there would be peace. And so this question arises in his mind, where is it that nama and rupa fade out and cease without remainder? So then this thought having formed in his mind and also being a gifted meditator, then, as it says, that the pathway to the heavenly realms opens up before him. And so he, in his absorption, in his meditation, he goes up into the heavenly realm of the four great kings. And he asks the ministers of the four great kings, you know, these devatas, these angelic beings, can you tell me, where is it that earth, water, fire and wind, where nama and rupa, where name and form fade out and cease without remainder? And they said, oh, well, we're just, you know, we just work here. You know, this is deep stuff. You know, you better ask the four great kings themselves. You know, we're just the guards here. You know? So he gets an audience with the four great kings, the guardian deities. And he says, excuse me, your majesties, I'd like to know, you know, where is it that mind and body, earth, water, fire and wind, material form and the mind, you know, fade out and cease without remainder. And they say, oh, no, we're just the guardians, you know, we just look after the world, you know, we're kind of protective deities, but this is way too deep for us. You better try upstairs. And so, you know, as it can be in these suttas, it goes through extraordinary and excruciating detail, you know, up to the heaven of the 33 gods, and then the ministers of Indra, and then Indra, and then up to the heaven of the Yama Devas, and then the Tusita Devas, and the Nimanarati Devas, the Devas who delight in creation, the Devas who delight in the creations of others. He keeps saying, oh, sorry, you know, that's way too deep for us. You know, we're not philosophers, you know, we just enjoy the creations of others. You know, please, you know, we can't deal with this kind of stuff. You better ask, you know, if you could try up in the Brahma world, you know, go and see if you can ask the Brahma gods, because, you know, they're really refined and pure and radiant, and, you know, they know this kind of stuff. So, you know, please go ask them. So he carries on with his meditation, goes up into the realm of Mahabrahma. So then he appears in the Brahma world and says to the ministers, the retinue of Mahabrahma, say, you know, could you tell me where it is that earth, water, fire and wind, where nama and rupa, where body and mind, you know, fade out and cease without remainder? They say, sorry, but then, you know, this is really Mahabrahma's territory. You know, we're just the ministers here. You know, we are Brahma gods indeed. That's the fact. But, you know, but Mahabrahma, you know, he'll definitely have all the answers. So please, you know, you'd be better off waiting to see if you can speak with him. He says, well, where is Mahabrahma? And they say, well, we don't know, but, you know, if you just wait and you sort of put out a call, maybe, you know, a light will appear and his divine majesty will manifest, and then, you know, you can put your question to him. So sure enough, he patiently waits, and then a light appears, and then Mahabrahma manifests. And so the monk puts his question, saying, excuse me, your divine majesty, can you please tell me where it is that earth, water, fire and wind, and long and short and coarse and fine, where the body and mind fade out and cease without remainder? And Mahabrahma says, I am Brahma. I am the great Brahma, the almighty, wielder of mastery and father and creator of all that are and are to be. So then the monk very politely says, well, thank you very much, your divine majesty, but I didn't actually ask that. What I asked was, where is it that mind and body, where earth, water, fire and wind fade out and cease without remainder? And of course, This being a Buddhist story, they do this three times over. I am Brahma, the great Brahma, the almighty father and wielder of mastery, father of all that are and are to be. So after the third time that they go through this, then, as it says in the story, Mahabrahma takes him by the elbow and leads him aside and says, look, you're embarrassing me in front of my retinue. You know. Yeah. I don't know where earth, water, fire and wind, where body and mind fade out and cease without remainder. And besides, you know, you're a disciple of the Buddha, so, you know, you've done wrong in coming up here all the way to the Brahma world. You should have gone to your own master, because definitely, you know, he'll understand this. So then the monk kind of scoots back down to the world and then comes out of his hut and goes to see the Buddha. Yeah. And so then he pays his respects and asks the Buddha the same question. And the Buddha said, well, you know, you're like a land-seeking bird, like from Noah's Ark, you know, sending out the bird to seek out land after the flood. And he said, like a land-seeking bird, you've flown out from the ship and you've gone here and gone there and you couldn't find land, so you've come back to the ship. So here we are. Welcome back to the ship. So the reason why you couldn't get an answer was because you were putting the question in the wrong way. So rather than asking where it is that nama and rupa, where body and mind and earth, water, fire and wind fade out and cease without remainder, rather what you should have asked is, where is it that body and mind, where earth, water, fire and wind can find no footing, where they cannot get a grip, where they cannot find a basis? That is how you should have posed the question. And the answer to that question, in the Pali he gives in the original, is Vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato bhavam. Did you get that? Vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato bhavam. So Vijnanam, in the consciousness, and this is one of the rare instances that the word consciousness doesn't mean discriminative consciousness, but a more transcendent awareness. Vijnanam anidasana means non-manifest or formless, without it's invisible. There's no visible form or structure, non-manifested. Vijnanam anidasanam anantam, limitless, infinite. Sabbato bhavam. Sabba means all, called complete. Pabha is light, so radiant in all directions. Or it also can mean, if you dissect the Pali slightly differently, it can also mean accessible from every side. So Vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato bhavam. The consciousness which is non-manifest, which is invisible, which is limitless, and which is radiant in all directions. Yeah. There it is, that long and short and coarse and fine and pure and impure, where earth, water, fire and wind can find no footing. They cannot find any traction, any basis. So there it is that mind and body, they come to completion. They are held in check in that, they reach their limit in that awareness, in that consciousness. So what that's describing is the awakened mind, or the mind of the arahant, that rather than the world of long and short and coarse and fine, pure and impure, the world of the four elements, earth, water, fire and wind, the world of things coming to an end where they stop and don't begin again, rather, it's the quality of mind where they have no place to land, and that when the mind is established in that quality of pure awareness, awake, limitless, radiant, that then the long and short and coarse and fine, pure and impure can be received and can be known, but they don't create any pressure. They are not a burden. They are not limiting. because the mind that knows them is limitless, is totally free. Another Ajahn Chah teaching on this same area is, one day somebody came to visit him at the main monastery and was being given a bit of a tour around, and the person was explaining that, yeah, we've got about 50 monks here in the monk section, about 60 or 70 nuns in the nun section, and Wat Pa Pong, the main monastery, this is just one of about 30 or 40 branch monasteries, and Lumpur Cha is the abbot of all of them. Yeah. And so, this person, then after having been given the tour, they came back and they were chatting with Ajahn Chah, and they said, yeah, this is incredible. How do you manage? I mean, all these monks, all these nuns, and then people coming to see you all day long, and just, and all these other branch monasteries, and people coming to you endlessly with their problems, their meditation issues, or they want new corrugated iron for the roofs on their huts, and they want you to deal with the local officials who are giving hassle, or they haven't got enough money to dig the foundations over there. All this stuff, and there's so much. I mean, how did you manage? This is just this great flood of things that you have to deal with every day. How do you do it? And they were standing outside the temple when they were having this conversation. And near the temple, the shrine hall at Ajahn Chah's monastery, there were these old boundary stones, these big, ancient carved stones that form the monastery boundaries. Some of them had been given, arranged there in front of the temple. And Ajahn Chah says, see that rock? I say, yeah. I say, yeah. Is it heavy? He says, yeah, it's a huge stone. Like, it's, 1.5, 2 meters tall, about 40, 50 centimeters thick. Yeah, that's a heavy rock. He says, not if you don't pick it up. So he's got a very earthy and a briefer way of explaining these things. So this is an important principle. And with this quality, when we establish this quality of pure knowing, of clear awareness, then we find that we can receive long and short and coarse and fine, pure and impure, the whole world of things, stuff. Whether you're a newspaper editor or a telephone exchange operator, or you're just dealing with life in Tel Aviv or Amravati, then that you find that there is space for all of it. There is the capacity to receive it, because that awareness, that mind, is not giving it a basis, not giving it a place to land. There's still attention to it. There's still the receiving of it and the sensitivity in relationship to it, but the mind is not picking it up. Is not burdened by it. There's another related teaching, which is also very well known, where this another devata. There's lots of devas appearing in these Dhamma talks. It's not deliberate, but just so happens. And so on this particular occasion, there was this deva called Rohitasa who came to see the Buddha, and Rohitasa came to the Buddha and asked this question. Said, when I was a human being, I was a yogi, and I had great psychic powers. I could walk through the sky. I was a skywalker, as he said. Not Luke, but Rohitasa, the skywalker. I could walk from one side of India to the other in a single stride. And I made this resolution that I would keep walking until I came to the end of the world. And even though I walked for 100 years, and I just kept going, every day, I only ever paused just to eat when I needed to, or to rest the body, or to answer the calls of nature. I kept going and going and going, and I walked for 100 years, but I still couldn't get to the end of the world. And I died on the way. I died before I could reach the end of the journey. So can you tell me, is it possible to reach the end of the world? And the Buddha said, it is impossible. It is not possible to reach the end of the world by walking. But I tell you, Rohitasa, that unless you reach the end of the world, you won't reach the end of suffering. So, again, he gets your attention. So, okay, so how do you work that out? Yeah. So he said, it is in this very body, in this, this fathom long body, this 6 foot long body, with its thoughts and feelings and perceptions. In this body, there is the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. So that, in that respect, he uses that same form that he does for the Four Noble Truths. And so, so it's through knowing the world of our senses, knowing the world of this life, these perceptions and feelings. We see the world arising within the space of this life through these eyes, these ears, this body, this mind that we have. Here is the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. So, in essence, it means, you know, it's right here that we can see that the quality of ending. And as I was referring to earlier today, that the development of the Third Noble Truth is a sense of when the world ends, when a feeling ends, when a thought ends, when things cease, when that spaciousness is there, then it's the most difficult aspect of Dharma practice is like letting that spaciousness be left open. To not fill that up with the next thing to be doing, rather than looking at space or silence or stillness. It's like at the end of the sitting, one, two. Before you get to about 4 seconds, okay, what's next? That's the way it is throughout our life. The mind doesn't like to stay with space or silence or peace. Again, peace is really boring. As Ajahn Sumedho would often say, you never see the Daily Mirror or the Sun with a headline, Ajahn Sumedho made a mindful inhalation. Yeah. It would not sell many papers, you know. Buddhist monk breathes in mindfully. You know, it's sex and violence is what sells papers. A monk breathing is not news. Again, those in the newspaper industry will know that well-behaved people do not sell newspapers. Yeah. It's when there's, you know, there's tragedy, crisis, sex and violence, shock, horror. That's what sells the papers. So, that's why that this, when there are those moments of clarity, when the quality of the awake mind is established, and we can know directly that in a way that vijñānaṁ anidasanaṁ, the consciousness that is limitless, which is bright, which is aware, that even though it might be just there for a moment, then the work is to keep that sustained, to establish that as an ongoing attitude, as an abiding presence, so that then that isn't just a fleeting moment, but something that we sustain and learn, in a sense, to let that be the very foundation of our experience. It's also interesting, as an aside, that in the Tibetan tradition, in the practice of Dzogchen, when they're describing what's called Rigpa, and Rigpa is the Tibetan word for vijja. So, ma Rigpa is avijja, or ignorance. Rigpa is the word for vijja, or awareness, knowing. This is exact translation. So, in the standard descriptions of Rigpa, at least from the Tibetan lamas I've hung out with, the English translation is empty in essence, cognizant in nature, unconfined in capacity. Those are three standard qualities of Rigpa. So this happens to match up exactly. So empty in essence, anidasana, cognizant in nature, vijñānaṁ, unconfined in capacity, ananta. And also the, another of the qualities of it is you, instead of, say cognizant in nature, it's also, of the nature of clarity. So that also relates to the quality of pabhasara or the, or brightness or radiance. So, my pet theory is that that particular phraseology out of the Tibetan has sort of, somehow wound its way through the Himalayas from the Pali texts, and that's, that same format has, found its expression there because it's exactly the qualities of vijja, or that awareness. And that when there is avijja, when there's ignorance, and again, just like the word wisdom in Pali is not knowing about things, ignorance is not, it isn't, it does not mean not knowing information. The ordinary use of the English word ignorance means not having the data or not knowing the information. In terms of Dhamma, ignorance is unawareness. It's like the mind not being clearly awake. It's not being fully aware of that quality of awareness being obstructed by greed, hatred, or delusion of some kind. It also, in this respect, it kind of relates to the conversation we were having earlier. Our friend with the red blanket was asking about intention and how that was sort of seen in terms of Buddhist thought and Buddhist psychology and in terms of karma. And just as we were talking, I was reminded of a point that Ajahn Sumedho would often make, because he grew up in a Christian tradition and was, at one point he was even training for the Christian ministry, which is not a well-known fact, in his late teens before he lost his faith in Christianity at about the age of 20. For a few months he was sort of moving towards training to be a Christian minister. But one of the things that really bugged him, that was one of the teachings of Jesus that he couldn't quite deal with, was where, and I can't quote this accurately, somewhere in the New Testament, Jesus says, if a man has a thought of lust towards a woman, it's as if, it's exactly the same as if he has committed adultery. And so that, on the intuitive level, the young Ajahn Sumedho said, that can't be right. And then when he came across Buddhist psychology later on, he thought, oh, that's more like it. Because also he felt that was asking too much of us as human beings. That if we have an angry impulse or a lustful impulse or a jealous impulse, that it happens too fast for us to be able to control. And it's, and also that feeling of it's not the same. and so that's a faculty or a factor of experience I would also heartily agree with, that we can have an impulse of desire or have an interest or an intention towards aversion or jealousy, irritation or destructiveness. But those things arise according to that they are the, in a way, the effects of past karma. Because of our, the way we've thought or acted in the past, that triggers the tendencies, the things that arise. But what we see within Buddhist practice is that, that quality of openness, what I've been describing as, radical acceptance, is a radical acceptance of the effects of past causes. We need to be open to the effects of the choices that we've made. We receive them. We know them. But we don't have to act on them. We don't have to invest them with value. But they've already been caused. It's like, you put in the order, it's been delivered. you might change your mind about the order, but it's on its way. And so it shows up. You know? And so, it's like that, you know, we've created a cause in the past of some kind, and so then it has its effect. So, in this moment, that openness of heart, that radical acceptance, is part of it is receiving with an open heart the effects of past causes. Then the second part of how we handle the present moment is then planting skillful causes that will ripen in wholesome ways in the future. And the more mindfulness, the more the clarity and openness there is, then the more that we can receive those past effects without confusion, and that we can plant the causes for benefit, again, without confusion or without being distorted by it. Desire or jealousy or fear or negative emotions, if that makes sense. So there's another little story I might tell in this respect is a different Ajahn this time, Lumpur Dun, who is a student of Ajahn Mun, who was Ajahn Chah's teacher. So Lumpur Dun was another of Ajahn Mun's original disciples, and I met him once. I had this great fortune, and he looked like this. He was a tiny little guy. He was maybe about 90 or 95 when I met him, and he had these little round glasses, and he was really kind of hunched over, and he was just like this sort of glowing, ochre-robed little ball of metta. I mean, he just kind of sat there, radiating kindness, And this had this extraordinarily benign, beautiful presence, like the sweetest old grandpa you ever met. And so he was just staying at a monastery where I happened to be visiting, and so I had the good fortune to encounter him at that time. And he, at the age of about 95, he went into hospital for the first time in his life. And so one of his students thought, well, the Ajahn's getting very, very old now. And so, you know, while he's in hospital, and we should do some interviewing and get some of his words down, because it's going to be lost to the world soon. So he had been going in to talk to his teacher, to Lumpur Dun, take some notes and have some dialogues with him. So he'd been doing this for a while. And then one day he sort of picked up his courage and he said, Lumpur, you know, in your Dhamma talks, sometimes you say that when you were a young man, you used to have a lot of anger, that you're a really angry person. You know, it's very hard to believe now because, you know, your presence is so kind and so radiant, so gentle. But, you know, is it, you know, forgive me for asking, and don't want to sound rude, but, you know, do you still experience anger? And Lumpur Dun had a reputation of being an arahant. So it was a bit of an unusual question. And to the fellow's surprise, who was interviewing him, Lumpur Dun said, "Oh yes." "Oh yes." Yeah, with a big smile. And then the way he phrased it in Thai was, "Me, there my ao," which means, "Yes, it shows up, but I don't accept it." It's like they deliver the package. No, I'm not going to sign for that. That's not mine. And so that is also very helpful. That, you know, an arahant, at least according to this particular pattern of things, that they'll still have those results of past karma. That you have a habit of being angry, then those angry impulses might arise, but just like in the Kevada Sutta, they got no place to land. There's no traction. There's no grip. And so, that might show up as a angry impulse. But, there's nobody picking it up. There's nowhere for it to land. It's just not got any kind of, say fuel to support it, so it just ceases. It comes to that wave of feeling comes to an end. So this, even though we talk about arahants and great masters, and they're all sort of somewhere else, some other time, they've all died anyway. I think, well, it's all very far away and it's distant, and it's sort of tales. There's not tales just out of the Bible or out of ancient history, but But the reason why we tell these stories is because it's relevant to us now, and our minds are really no different than the mind of Ajahn Chah or the Buddha or Lumpur Dun or any of these great beings, that our mind is the same as their mind. It's the same mind. You know, it works in the same way. It's built of the same stuff. And so these teachings there give us an example of what's possible for us, and that the usefulness of a retreat time like this is to explore those possibilities and to see how this works, and that and to be able to, in a sense, get a feeling, a direct feeling, an appreciation, realization of how the mind established in that quality of vijja, of awareness, can be in the face of something very painful, very difficult, or very complicated, and yet be perfectly at peace. And as Ajahn Chah put it, peace doesn't come from being alone or being with others. Peace comes from right understanding. So I offer those thoughts for our consideration this evening, and we can close with the Buddha's words on loving kindness. And some of you might have been wondering why this extra sheet of paper floated into existence today. Well, this is because this page was missing from the original first edition. So this page 37, if we can have a bit of light, if someone will be kind enough. So unsurprisingly, page 37 comes after page 36. Actually, after page 35, to be honest. So it starts on page 35, the English version, and then this extra sheet comes in following that. So after the lines "and downwards to the depths," it goes to "outwards and unbounded." So it begins on page 35.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
We'll close with the closing homage, page 16.
Arahaṁ sammasambuddho bhagavā, the Lord, the perfectly enlightened and blessed one, buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ abhivādhemi. I render homage to the Buddha, the blessed one. Svākato Bhagavata Dhammo, the teachings so completely explained by him, Dhammam Namassami, I bow to the Dhamma. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho, the blessed ones, disciples who have practiced well, Sangham Namami, I bow to the Sangha.